Chapter 13. Descent. The compound that housed the Dalai Lama and the leadership of his Tibetan exile in Dharamshala was protected by three rings of security. Furthest out were Indian police, next were members of a paramilitary border force, and closest in were a group of elite commandos. In the summer of 2008, a pair of computer experts passed through these layers and then an airport-style security check before finally reaching the inner sanctum. These were tense days. Beijing was about to host the Olympics, and in March of that year, some of the worst violence seen in years had flared up in Tibet itself, with riots on the streets. At the same time, the cyber-espionage campaign against the Tibetans was intensifying. Because they were outsiders, it took a few days for the two visitors, Greg Walton and Shishir Nagaraja, to win the trust of the Tibetans. But by the third day, they were allowed to hook up their monitoring equipment to the Tibetan computer system. "We turned over a stone and found a whole bunch of worms," says Nagaraja. For all the physical security around the Tibetan government in exile, their electronic systems had been penetrated. There was no need to sneak past the commandos and infiltrate a spy into Dharamshala. The Chinese were already inside the walls. In the Second World War, Britain had made sure that every time it used intelligence based on breaking Enigma, there was another reason for the successful action that would be plausible to the Germans, a spotter plane seeing a ship rather than the traffic being red. But the Chinese had not quite learnt that lesson. They had shown their hand by being a bit too sloppy in the way they used the intelligence they were gleaning. The Dalai Lama's office had noticed that meetings it privately arranged with leaders of other countries were almost immediately being cancelled. The Chinese have long-run campaigns against foreign officials who meet the Tibetan spiritual leader, including British. But around 2008, these meetings were being cancelled almost as soon as the invitations were mailed out, and long before they were public. The diplomatic traffic was one of two sensitive areas where a fear of compromise had led to the visit of the two computer experts, Walton and Nagaraja. The other was a database of refugees who had fled Tibet and who might be wanted by the Chinese authorities, and whose families, back in Tibet, might be at risk. Nagaraja was shocked by the implications of that database being compromised. "I have never actually come across data which, if leaked, could lead to the death of a human. I've never honestly come across that before or since." Tubten Samdup, who had first helped bring the internet to Dharamshala, had gone on to set up a project in which teams of activists went into chat rooms to communicate directly with young Chinese people in order to try to present a different picture of Tibet. Websites about Tibet were blocked in China, but online chat rooms offered a way to reach ordinary people. But when one young woman, who was part of Samdup's team, returned to her family village in Chinese Tibet, she was detained as she crossed the border and held for 2 months incommunicado by Chinese security personnel. She denied being involved in political activity and said she had been away simply to study. But then a Chinese intelligence officer pulled out a dossier on her activities. These included transcripts of her internet chats as part of Samdup's team going back years. The Chinese had clearly been spying on the conversations. "That scared everyone in my office," says Samdup. "Social media had facilitated dissent, but also its surveillance." During their week-long visit, Walton and Nagaraja put in place real-time monitoring of Tibetan networks and email service. As they did this, they could immediately see confidential documents on the move. "You have all this security," Nagaraja says of the rings of commandos and troops on the outside, "but the Chinese never actually needed to breach any of them. They came through the wires." It appeared the Chinese had been all over the private office and email systems back to 2005. Walton recalls watching documents being infiltrated off the system in front of him and the Dalai Lama's aides. It was having their worst fears confirmed, he says. The penetration was global. The team eventually located 1,295 computers that had been infected in 103 countries with a Trojan horse that provided real-time control of a targeted computer for an attacker, allowing files to be extracted. The microphones and cameras increasingly available on a computer could also be turned on remotely. This allowed audio and images to be sent back in the way a bug or covert video camera might have done in the past, but without all the effort of breaking into a premises and installing them. A person's computer could, unbeknownst to them, be turned into a spy. Emails had come to monks, seemingly from other monks, but containing malware. Messages were intercepted in transit and legitimate attachments replaced with malicious payloads, giving attackers full access. One monk said he saw the ghostly sight of his own email system opening up and then sending an infected attachment to other people without him touching the keyboard. The investigators found something else, a website used by the attacks for command and control. And the attackers had failed to protect it with a password. That allowed a group called Citizen Lab in Canada, which supports activists and a free internet against state surveillance, to run a classic counter-espionage operation, spying on the enemy spies. The attackers had meticulously compiled an inventory of all of the organizations that they'd managed to infiltrate, says Ron Dibert, head of Citizen Lab. As well as Tibetan machines, Citizen Lab saw hundreds of other computers compromised around the world, including diplomatic traffic from Iran, Bangladesh, Latvia, Indonesia, India, South Korea, Germany, and Pakistan, as well as international organizations like the UN and even the mail server of Associated Press in Hong Kong. It was a mind-blowing experience watching it all, says Dibert. Researchers set up a honeypot to watch what happened to their own computers and saw that the attackers seemed to be connecting from Hainan Island in China, home to a signals intelligence facility of the PLA. China's use of electronic espionage to seek out dissent would wrap round the globe, and in doing so, it led to a collision between one of the most powerful tech companies in the world and the Chinese state. A battle that drew in a young student. 20-year-old Tenzin Seldon received an unusual phone call in January 2010. She was a student at Stanford, and one of her resident fellows was on the line. He sounded worried. "Something very important came up," he said. "It's not life-threatening, but I need you to be here in your dorm right now." Seldon headed over to meet him. He explained that he had just received a phone call from the president of Stanford University, John Hennessy. Hennessy was a well-connected man who sat on the board of Google. Hennessy said he had a warning to be passed on to the young student. Her computer had been compromised, her account breached, and the Chinese government were likely spying on her. She needed to call a senior Google official. Looking back on the scene, the funniest thing for Seldon was the way the resident fellow conveyed this to her, as if this were some dramatic revelation in a spy film. Her attitude was, "Okay, and?" For Seldon, the spying was anything but a surprise. For me, it was just every day. State espionage seemed mundane to Tenzin Seldon, because she was an activist and organizer in the Free Tibet movement. Her parents had fled Tibet on foot for the Himalayan mountains in India, where she had been born. She came to the U.S. as a teenager and became involved in the Tibetan cause at high school. She was used to the idea that the Chinese government might be spying on her. Her first experience dated from 2008. Seldon had been organizing protests against China when the Olympic torch relay for the Beirut Games had been going through her hometown, San Francisco. It was a hugely symbolic moment for China, and Selden and her friends were determined to use it to draw attention to the plight of the Tibetans living under Chinese rule. That meant organizing protests. But Selden and her fellow activists noticed they were getting emails from each other that they had not sent. They would say things like, "I need you to open this attachment. It's related to our media strategy." Other members of the Tibetan community were getting emails saying, "Hi, I'm Tenzin. I'm doing well here, and here's an attachment that I really wanted to forward you regarding what's going on in San Francisco." She knew she had not sent this message. Someone was manipulating email accounts to try to gain access to the group and work out their plans. The route for the torch seemed to change at one point to avoid a protest they had been organizing secretly over email. Selden was also taking part in a U.S. film production about Tibet. From 2008, that team found themselves under cyber attack. One member of the crew realized that her laptop was occasionally capturing image of what was on the screen. The cursor would move round by itself and the machine would switch itself off. The team found that when they arrived in China, cyber espionage was combined with traditional physical surveillance, as they were followed by 8 to 10 vehicles and videotaped by security personnel. Hotel rooms were searched. Back in the US and Europe, producers and editors involved in the project or linked to the team found their email accounts accessed and other machines failing. That history was why, in January 2010, she was almost nonplussed by the revelation that she was again a target. Once more, emails were being sent round the Tibetan community from her account, but not by her, and her account was mysteriously suspended. But this time, she was caught up in a bigger game. A few days after the initial warning, a senior director of Google called up and asked to inspect her laptop. "Why?" she asked. "We want to see what kind of techniques the Chinese government used," he explained. Curious, and so that she could learn how to protect herself better and find out what she had done wrong to let them in, she agreed he could come and pick it up from her dorm. A few days later, he returned it to her with a message. "Google will be making a very important decision today," he said, "and you should watch out for it in the newspaper." The Google official was cautious in what he revealed about their investigation, but it seemed as if, at the same time as she was accessing her account from Stanford, two or three other people were accessing it from other places in the world. "What about the laptop?" Selden asked. "Did they find anything?" "The strangest part in all of this, Tenzin, is that we did not find anything," the Google man said. That was strange, since often an account is compromised by spyware being placed in the laptop and its software. The attackers had got in another way, not through the laptop and Selden, but through Google itself. That day, Google did something unusual. It went public about being attacked. On its own blog, the company announced it had been the victim of a sophisticated cyber attack. That decision reflected outrage at the highest levels of the tech giant. Google, like many companies, had not thought much about state-sponsored espionage until it was too late. In the company's early years, the main threat was people taking the site offline. Then it was criminals. But this time, the hackers showed no interest in things like the credit card database for customers, but were after email accounts and the like. Suddenly, we were looking at a different kind of adversary, one where there wasn't necessarily a monetary component to the crime or the event, recalls Heather Adkins, who had worked on the company's security back in 2002. This was a broad and deep attack. It first became aware of the attack in mid-December after technical checks the company had put in place, which it is reluctant to discuss in detail but are thought to involve large-scale data monitoring, spotted something anomalous occurring within the corporate network. Google seemed to have been penetrated initially by a carefully targeted chat message containing a link to a photo-sharing website. This used a previously undisclosed vulnerability to give the attackers a foothold from which to explore Google's internal system. The security team quickly realized the sophistication was a step up from anything they had seen before. Suspicion fell quickly on the Chinese government, although it was impossible to prove definitively. "You have to do a mind shift," says Adkins of the realization that the team was up against a state with all its resources and not just a lone hacker or two. Concern escalated to the top of the company, with some of the most senior executives, like Sergey Brin, taking a personal interest in the battle against the intruders. The attack was codenamed Aurora because the term appeared in the malicious code. The impact on Google as a whole was colossal, like a tornado moving through the company in terms of momentum and velocity, insiders say. The security team worked long hours over Christmas, some to the point of exhaustion, trying to pin down what was going on and rooting out the parasite which had got inside. The team also saw other companies being hit by the same campaign, often high-tech companies, and so began notifying them. The target at Google seemed to be people. "This was certainly something we believed was aimed at our users ultimately," says one person. Those users included Tibetan activists like Tenzin Seldon. But the more it looked, the more the security team found to worry about. When it went public, Google focused on the espionage against human rights groups by getting into the Google network. This was only one part of the attack. The attackers had also been targeting the source code of Google's applications. If you have the source code, you can understand how a system is made and where the vulnerabilities are. Google has remained quiet about what exact source code was stolen. Some accounts said it involved the password system that controlled access to all services, known as Gaia. Going after the source code was a common feature of the wider campaign known as Aurora. The attackers also seem to have targeted the database and portals that contained requests from government and law enforcement for wiretaps or access to people's accounts. This, along with other attempts to get similar information from Microsoft around the time, suggests a counterintelligence function. By finding out who U.S. law enforcement was asking for data on, a foreign intelligence agency could learn which of its agents the American authorities might have discovered. Attackers also looked for other sensitive information, like the certificates that validate a piece of software before it is downloaded, although they did not capture this. This suggested that Google was both a target in itself and, because of its wide-scale use, a means by which to get to other companies and people. Google began to reach out to cyber experts who worked specifically on espionage against activists to see if they could help, Brin calling them late at night. But when some of those people picked up their messages the next day and called back, they found that Google no longer seemed as keen for their help. There was a reason. Google had approached not just them, but America's NSA, originally the FBI, who pointed them to Fort Meade. And once the NSA had signed a secret agreement with Google, it did not want any outsiders involved as its teams began to analyze the way in which the attackers had got in. The NSA had worked with parts of the defense industry in the past, but Google had not come knocking, thinking perhaps that as it was an American company, the American government would automatically protect it against other states. According to one account in Vanity Fair magazine, Google called the NSA and said, "You were supposed to protect us from this." The NSA guys just fell out of their chairs. They could not believe how naive the Google guys had been. When it went public in mid-January 2010, Google stated that the primary goal of the attackers was accessing the Gmail accounts of Chinese human rights activists, and said it believed they had failed, only getting into two accounts in a limited fashion. But they also saw that, independent of the direct attack on Google, the accounts of dozens of US, China, and Europe-based Gmail users who are advocates of human rights in China had been routinely accessed thanks to other vulnerabilities. Google announced in its blog that the attacks were forcing it to reconsider its business relationship with China. Reports said the attacks could be linked to universities in the country, which might be acting in concert with the state. The company said it was no longer willing to continue censoring results on its Chinese website, google.cn, and would begin discussions to see whether that meant shutting down the site, along with its offices in China. It moved to Hong Kong, where the restrictions were looser. This was a direct challenge to Beijing, American corporate power against the most populous state on the planet. This salvo from Google to Beijing was about more than just the Aurora attack. It was a shot across Beijing's bows and the latest skirmish in a battle going back years. When Google entered the Chinese market in 2006, there was a big question. How could a company that believed in the free flow of information operate with a government that sought to control the free flow of information? The answer initially was an accommodation. After discussions in the US, Google said it would censor results according to Chinese law, but would put up a disclosure notice when this happened and would provide an uncensored US-hosted site which was subject to US law. It also said it would not disclose to the government any personal information about its users or their search habits. For some activists, like Tenzin Seldon at the time, this was still a betrayal of Google's famous motto, "Don't be evil." "You are kowtowing to Chinese law," she had argued, believing the companies were in a stronger position than they thought to dictate terms and not compromise their principles. "It really sickened me." Critics thought the company was selling out to get into the massive Chinese market, but it did not work out that way. The requests for censorship began to come into Google from the Chinese authorities, most in the first few years related to pornography and illegal activities, much the same as elsewhere. But there were also requests to remove political information about sensitive subjects like Tibet and Tiananmen Square. In all, about 1% of search results were blocked. But Google still found its website periodically blocked over the next 3 years by the Chinese government, allegedly for failing to block pornography. Events took a turn for the worse from the run-up to the Beijing 2008 Olympics onwards, when the government was trying to clamp down on dissent. Many of the requests to take down content were thought by Google to be frivolous, particularly when dealing with official corruption or embarrassing stories about officials. The company tried to resist, leading to anger from the authorities. Chinese officials made it increasingly clear that they wanted a link removed that allowed people to move to the uncensored Google.com site from the censored Google.cn. By the spring of 2009, the request became even firmer. This apparently came about after one Politburo standing committee member in charge of propaganda discovered that if he entered his own name, a raft of critical results turned up. Google resisted, but the Chinese started to put commercial pressure on them, telling telecoms companies to stop doing business with Google. Google decided at this point it did not want to go public on the pressure, so asked the US government for help in contacting Chinese officials in support of the company. But the Aurora attack pushed Google over the edge into direct confrontation. Some of the staff inside Google had themselves been deeply uncomfortable with the accommodation with Beijing, which in turn heightened their anger when the hacking was discovered. "We did a deal with them and they still hacked us," is how one outraged person who worked at the company at the time puts it. Ironically, they would say exactly the same thing about the US government in a few years' time. In Beijing, a well-placed contact of the US embassy told its diplomats that the Aurora intrusions were directed from the very top. The contact said the Politburo Standing Committee had been behind it. Another contact suggested that one top official was also working with the leading Chinese competitor search engine Baidu against Google. There was a perception in Beijing that the US government and Google were working hand in hand to drive a vision of internet freedom into China which the government did not want. Hillary Clinton, the US Secretary of State, waded in. On the 21st of January 2010, she made a major speech calling for internet freedom, but Chinese internet censors were, somewhat predictably, deployed in force to block coverage of and commentary on it within the country. The reaction from the Chinese Foreign Ministry and newspapers was deeply critical, talking of a Cold War mentality. And even some of those supportive of her views in China were dismayed. In conversations over the next few days, they told the US embassy that it was turning the issue of internet freedom into an us versus them debate between the US and China, which would make it harder for them to make their voices heard without being seen as pawns of the United States. They privately warned US diplomats that Chinese officials regarded US efforts to promote internet freedom as an attack, and that members of the Politburo saw the insistence on the issue as an attempt to undermine social and political stability and instigate unrest. The speech, some warned bitterly, would now give more power to those trying to establish control. To the Chinese, the timing looked suspicious. Hillary Clinton was making a major speech just after the Google announcement. She had also had dinner with Google's CEO, Eric Schmidt, earlier in the month. For the Chinese, this confirmed their impression that Google was an arm of American power. They were two sides of the same coin. Western tech interests were aligned with Western foreign policy interests. The West's so-called internet freedom actually is a type of cyber hegemony, wrote a PLA lieutenant general involved in foreign relations and intelligence in January 2013. Battle was now well and truly joined in a simmering conflict over cyber espionage and who was in charge of the internet. Evangelists for the internet often say that technology knows no borders. And when the Clinton administration liberalized technology in the 1990s, it undertook the move believing that the internet was an unstoppable force for globalization. It certainly has connected people around the world in ways no one could have predicted. It also made American companies rich along the way. States were at first caught in the headlights of this seemingly all-powerful force which threatened to challenge their authority and legitimacy and even their tax revenue. But then they began to fight back. It turned out that the internet could have borders for good and for ill. States might need to find new ways to exercise their power and sovereignty in cyberspace, and in some cases their power would be constricted, but in others it might even be enhanced. This was true for every state, from authoritarian to democratic, but China, home of the world's largest population of internet users, is where that has become most apparent. In the Chinese state, computer espionage was a double-edged sword. On the international front, it offered the opportunity for the Chinese to spy abroad, but also for other, more powerful players to spy on China. Domestically, it provided the means for dissidents and others to organize and potentially subvert the rule of the Communist Party, but could it also provide the means to spy on them? Maintaining internal stability is the number one priority for the Chinese state, and so while cyber espionage on intellectual property may have attracted the most attention, the domestic use of computers for internal control is far more significant for the regime. The first email from China went over an academic network in 1987. "Across the Great Wall we can reach every corner of the world," it announced. 2 years later, students occupied the vast space of Tiananmen Square in Beijing, demanding the opening up of their country and greater democracy. From Hong Kong, then still a British outpost on the edge of China, GCHQ intercepted PLA military communications as a tense standoff developed. As they listened in, the British analysts realized that rumors of splits in the army were false. The tanks were sent in and crushed the protests, leading to a still unknown number of deaths. The communist regime had survived its greatest scare, but now it was determined to retain control. By the mid-1990s, it was becoming clear that the Internet could be used for more than professors talking to each other. Activists and hackers were emerging online, and the Chinese state was beginning to think seriously about how to exert control. In 1997, it passed a Public Security Bureau regulation which required domestic Internet providers to monitor and report anti-regime sentiment, a concept cast in broad terms. The Internet is not some ethereal creation which exists in a cloud. It depends on a physical infrastructure of cables and routers, like the British telegraph system. This may be built and operated by either the state or the private sector in the form of national telecoms companies. Whatever the case, it offers the chance for states to exert control over the system, to exercise the modern version of cable censorship. In China, the desire to exert control meant building what has become known colloquially as the Great Firewall of China. This is modern border control. Rather than a man in a uniform, a technical border post operates at the entry points where the cables and routers bring the Internet into China. They will let most data through and into the country, but keep undesirables out. This will include a spectrum of content ranging from pornography to political dissent. Sit in a hotel room in China and search for certain sensitive websites you know are out there, and you hit a blank, an error message as if the page does not exist. You have just reached the Great Firewall. It began by blocking reports from certain foreign websites, primarily news providers, sometimes completely, sometimes only certain articles which were deemed subversive. As social media emerged, sites like Twitter and YouTube were excluded entirely. As time has gone on, the system has become subtler in seeking out what is deemed subversive material, blocking certain pages and also peering into the packets of data travelling past. This process is known as deep packet inspection. This is the equivalent of opening up all the mail at the sorting and censorship offices that Britain ran in the First World War, except it can now be automated so that rather than having a censor sitting and reading everything, a machine can look for suspicious words or items or traffic coming from a particular Internet address. This technology and technique, like so many in the cyber world, can be used defensively or offensively. The boundaries are often very hazy. It can be used to look for a malicious piece of code that you fear is being sent into your country, the equivalent of a letter from a foreign state to a spy in your country, or for something sensitive being sent out, details of troop movements to a foreign power, but could also be used to filter or monitor a broader category of subversive material. Of course, the crucial question is who gets to decide what is subversive. In China's case, this might mean blocking material coming in from a foreign newspaper if it mentions Tibet or Falun Gong, for instance, or discusses the personal wealth of senior members of the Chinese Politburo. It is possible to jump the Great Firewall using technology, but this takes effort and risks drawing attention to yourself. China's fear is that the free Internet is a Western Trojan horse designed to introduce subversion by undermining social stability and promoting political change. Western companies are viewed both as ideologically subversive and also potentially as the actual vectors for espionage. The Chinese have been extremely conscious of the Western domination of the Internet, from hardware through to commercial Internet companies. They became determined to challenge that dominance. Blocking certain foreign websites may have been motivated by internal security, but it also had the useful side effect of acting as a form of protectionism, which ensured the development of a powerful indigenous Chinese software industry, with Chinese versions of Google and Twitter growing to be giants, and not, of course, having the potential to spread Western ideas, a process aided by China's language. The Chinese are doing to the internet what they did to Buddhism 1,000 years ago, which was to comprehensively sinicize it and turn it into something very different from what it started out being, argues Nigel Inkster, a former deputy head of MI6 and a long-time China watcher. The Chinese internet has become a discrete phenomenon. This is the next significant development in the history of computers, spies, and the internet. The systems can be not just a tool for espionage, for stealing secrets from other countries and states, but a tool for domestic surveillance and monitoring, spying on your own population. Tibetan activists are not the only ones targeted. Falun Gong, democracy activists, people trying to mark the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, are also subject to cyber espionage and attack. And China, of course, is not the only country to do this. China has aggressively demanded information about subversive activity from internet providers, for instance, insisting on information from Yahoo about dissidents that led to their imprisonment. The government is also believed to have ensured back doors were installed in certain products, which meant that conversations people thought were secure and encrypted were in fact being recorded by the state when they used designated keywords like Tiananmen and democracy. Telecoms and internet companies say that when they operate in a country, they have to comply with that country's laws, providing lawful intercept or access to data for criminal investigation and national security. If they really do not want to do so, then the answer would be not to do business in that country. One telecoms insider says a fascinating difference in Chinese equipment is the higher capacity for lawful intercept. In the UK, equipment typically has the capacity to collect perhaps 1% of calls, but some Chinese kit can collect 14%, indicating the difference in appetite between the two states. This is all about following the law and the demands of national security, companies say. But the problem comes with how different states define these needs, and in particular, how much authoritarian states do so. China began adding a system for domestic internal monitoring rather than just controlling what came into the country under its broader Golden Shield program. This is done at a variety of different levels, local, regional, and national, and tracks public opinion and dissent. It involves an army of thousands of individual censors patrolling websites to remove inappropriate content and post pro-government messages on social media. The system of surveillance also creates a form of self-censorship by Chinese citizens online who are careful about what they say. That is not to say that the internet in China has not become vibrant. It is a powerful and also disruptive force. Chinese netizens are highly active and vocal, often holding power and authorities to account and forcing the pace on issues like corruption at a very local level. This can be a useful outlet for public anger, the authorities seem to believe, but only if it is kept channeled within certain paths and away from others. This also applies to the work of its hackers. In April 2001, a US spy plane was flying near Hainan Island. The island was home to a major Chinese PLA intelligence facility. It was the place where the intrusions into Tibetan computers would be traced to a few years later. The US military plane was collecting signals for the NSA, part of that global collection mission that had been built for the Cold War but persisted beyond its end. The Chinese unsurprisingly disliked the Americans flying so close and regularly sent their own fighter jets up to keep watch. On one occasion, a Chinese pilot got so close to the Americans that he held up a piece of paper with his email address on it for them to read. But that day in April, something went wrong, and there was a collision. The same Chinese pilot who had showed off his email died, and the American plane crash-landed on the island. Anger erupted in China. The capture of intelligence-gathering technology on board was a nightmare for the NSA, But another problem was the way in which patriotic hackers in China took to computers defacing American websites. On the Chinese side, this was led by a group known as the Honker Union of China. It was not one-way traffic, though. American patriotic hackers also targeted Chinese websites. There was speculation at the time that the damaging Code Red worm released onto the internet in July of that year might be the work of the Chinese, and that hackers probing utilities in California might also be connected, although there was no proof for either. This was the second major incident in clashes between patriotic hackers on both sides, the first having been in 1999 when the US bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the Kosovo conflict, leading to a spontaneous outburst of fury in China on the streets and online. The hacking of US websites was tolerated or even encouraged. But as the authorities began to fear things might get out of control and lead to serious unrest on the streets, they began to clamp down. Patriotic hackers may be just that, independent hackers motivated by nationalism. But they can also be highly plausible proxies for state intelligence activities seeking deniability. When the Honker Union or Red Hackers go after those critical of China, such as sites in Japan, are they acting independently or on the explicit orders of the state? Or is the state deliberately turning a blind eye to activity it could otherwise stop? This might offer some plausible deniability for governments carrying out a clandestine action. However, the more authoritarian a regime is, and especially the more control it exerts over domestic actors in cyberspace, the more likely it seems that it is involved in such activity. In China, hacking groups, which emerged around the turn of the millennium, seemed to have shifted to more advanced cyber-espionage work. This may be out of patriotism, but also perhaps because they were recruited by the state. Patriotic hackers sent out messages suggesting more organized activity was a far better use of their time. One message from the Honker Union of China in 2010 asked, "What benefit can hacking a web page bring our country and the people? It is only a form of emotional catharsis. Please do not launch any pointless attacks. The real attack is to fatally damage their network or gain access to their sensitive information." There are huge hacker forums in China where tips and tricks are shared, but the fact that there are more hackers in China than any other country is simply a reflection of the fact that there are more internet users in China than any other country. In these forums, it's thought, the government can watch them, pressuring those who are going down the wrong path and potentially recruiting those who are particularly talented. Western hackers are also active against China, for instance, targeting those responsible for building the Great Firewall because they view it as an affront to internet freedom. They may also publicize weaknesses in Chinese control systems and ways of evading censorship. The US may maintain that hackers within its shores who do this are entirely independent, but the Chinese see things differently. In 2004, China got a fright that confirmed the country's fears regarding its reliance on foreign computer technology. Microsoft was trying to clamp down on pirated versions of its operating system around the world and came up with a clever idea. Anyone not operating a properly licensed version of Windows would see his or her screen slowly turn to black and a message appear. The problem for China was that thanks to its liberal interpretation of intellectual property, pretty much every copy in the country was pirated, including those of government systems. And so computer screens all over the country suddenly went dark. What was known as the black screen of death produced a terrifying realization. An American company had just remotely switched off their computers. Maybe only for a short period, and maybe only to make a commercial point about privacy, But, seen from China, someone in faraway America had just hit the kill switch. There had been fears of just such a possibility from the start, and so began a huge campaign to protect hardware and software across the country, and especially in government, amid fears of the type of sabotage the CIA had conducted in the Soviet Union in the Farewell case. China introduced procedures to check that there were no back doors hidden in imported Western technology. This involved companies disclosing technical details and having them tested in labs. For instance, for Microsoft to sell its products to China, it had to agree that the government could look at some of the source code for the Windows operating system, something it had once jealously guarded. Under its government security program, the company provided a number of countries with managed access to some of the source code to reassure them that they were not installing back doors on behalf of the NSA. By getting access to the source code of foreign technology, China could also learn about vulnerabilities to exploit it. But this is similar to what Huawei has to do in Britain, and may be the only way of building trust in a globalized world. Increasingly, though, rather than import Western products and check them, China has moved on to build and develop its own software and hardware. The Chinese state and many of its netizens continue to believe that the U.S. has a kill switch it can use to cut off China from the Internet at will, and knowledge of an armful of vulnerabilities that could be deployed to the same effect. They may even be right. China thinks of information security in a different way from the West. It is not just about protecting information and keeping it secure. Rather, it is about the fact that information itself can be potentially subversive. Control of hardware, software, and information is therefore vital in order to guard against the risk of foreign subversion. This is the underlying reason behind the struggle with Google and for sovereignty in cyberspace. The Chinese Foreign Ministry is a grand building in central Beijing, whose guards click their heels and stand to attention as visitors approach. In an anteroom of its lobby, Dr. Huang Huikong, a legal advisor to the Foreign Ministry and one of the most senior negotiators on cyberspace, outlined the Chinese position in 2013. He agrees there is an ideological battle over cyberspace, but argues that the kind of state control China exercises is the type many countries use to ensure social order. Some people think this is a control of cyber flow of information, and it is a violation of human rights, but we don't think so. It is necessary for all the countries to establish a good order and make a balance between the inflow of information and the public security. He compares the Internet to a traffic highway, one that requires rules of the road agreed by states. He also, without naming the U.S., makes it clear that he believes certain countries have been driving dangerously. The diplomat repeats the oft-heard refrain that China is the victim, not the perpetrator, when it comes to hacking. Such activity is illegal and punishable by law, he explains, adding that China is one of those countries suffering most from hacker attacks. In 2013, Chinese officials claimed that more than 10 million Chinese computers were maliciously controlled from overseas, 30% by computers in the U.S. The realization that the state could, after all, exercise sovereignty over the Internet has set the stage for a significant global struggle. Britain, the U.S., and others talk of fighting for a multi-stakeholder Internet in which governments, companies, and civil societies jointly set the rules for cyberspace, and in which free speech is prioritized. But China and Russia lead the way in arguing that states should be free to exercise sovereignty within their borders in the way they traditionally have in the physical world, and then negotiate with each other about international rules through traditional state-on-state diplomacy. Russian and Chinese officials believe the Western talk of multi-stakeholder means, largely, American companies being free to do what they want at the cost of their own control over what happens in their country. Internet freedom, they think, is simply the freedom to be exploited and spied on by the US and its companies. One problem for Western countries is that many other states agree with the Chinese-Russian position. To them, the Internet looks like a rather large, scary creation in the face of which they feel helpless. Whatever their populations might want, the leaders, perhaps unsurprisingly, prefer a model in which they retain control to one whereby they lose it. Social stability, subversion, and dissent are all in the eye of the beholder. States beyond China, initially fearful of the net, have increasingly learnt to exert control through the infrastructure, often through telecoms companies, sometimes because they are state-owned, but even if not, regulations or pressure can be used. Some have created walled gardens where people are forced to stay within certain boundaries, or more correctly, it is made harder or more expensive to leave, a trend that analysts call network authoritarianism. The number of national firewalls has been growing as more and more countries institute internet border controls. Turkey, for instance, says it does that to make sure it is family safe, but it does not explain what exactly that means. Social media has been restricted in the country as part of broader regulation, with Twitter in particular targeted for spreading messages. When a coup is underway or a government fears protests will bring it down, its tanks now head to the internet and telecoms operators rather than the TV stations for control. The extreme act of hitting the kill switch and closing down communications is one that governments have also attempted. China took this step when there was unrest in Xinjiang province in 2009, a technique it had used as early as 1996, when computer bulletin boards were shut down in some universities to prevent anti-Japanese demonstrations being organized. Countries in the Middle East also hit the kill switch to try to prevent news of social protests and the organizing of those protests spreading during the Arab Spring. Social media were a way of escaping the grip of the state and pliant media. In Egypt, the authorities at one point took down Facebook because they feared its power to organize and demanded that government-dictated text messages be sent by phone operators to all customers. Officials also went to operators at gunpoint, demanding that networks be taken down, leaving the companies in little doubt about the consequences. When one country places a black box at its gateway to monitor all the traffic, it is legitimate law enforcement activity and vital for social stability. When someone else does it, it is often described as mass surveillance and censorship. Russia and China also point out that even ardent supporters of a free internet place controls and filter or monitor. Sometimes this is to keep out pornography, but can be for political purposes. For instance, neo-Nazi content is banned from online social media in Germany. Pressure to remove content or exert controls also grew in the West amid fears that social media was being used by groups like Islamic State to reach out and radicalize. But there were even debates over internet freedom when it came to less dramatic threats. In the summer of 2011, riots broke out on the streets of Britain. Shops were vandalized and burnt to the ground by mobs of young people after a pair of trainers, or simply to vent their anger. For a few days, the social fabric seemed to fray. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, focused on the way in which those involved were organizing and communicating over the internet. He said authorities were looking at whether it would be right to stop people communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder, and criminality. Such talk about blocking online activity for the sake of social stability might make the Chinese smile. When Colonel Gaddafi's brutal regime fell in Libya, visitors to ransacked offices of his secret police found evidence of how his grip on power had been maintained. There was the transcript of a 16-minute online chat in which a man flirted with a woman, but also confessed that he feared he was a target of the regime. Another message revealed a plea from an activist to a Human Rights Watch staffer for help. Just as revealing was the evidence pointing to Western companies having sold the monitoring technology. This apparently included the most advanced equipment which can inspect the content of packets of data. Similar evidence was found in Egypt after the fall of the Mubarak regime. And it was Western technology companies, those proponents of Internet freedom, who had initially helped build China's monitoring apparatus, supplying both the software and hardware for the Great Firewall. The tools of cyber espionage have now become a commodity that can be bought off the shelf, another product sold by the West to others to make money. Western companies are now among the most active in supplying monitoring software to authoritarian companies around the world, their brochures, not normally available online, boasting about the ability to provide surveillance and intercept. These are practices all governments undertake, but which assume a darker hue depending on how repressive a regime is. A brochure by a group called The Hacking Team talks about being able to monitor 100,000 targets through a single, easy-to-use interface. It talks of offering the ability to attack your target while they are browsing the internet, opening a document file, receiving a text message, or crossing the borders with his laptop. This is the kind of technology China developed against Tibetans, but it is now sold to Middle Eastern states going after human rights activists and dissidents whom they want to pursue in cyberspace. These companies maintain they only sell their products to governments for lawful interception, to catch criminals and terrorists. The problem, of course, is how different governments define terrorism and criminality. Many countries are now monitoring all their traffic and finding out that there may be less need to invest in training a spy service when you can purchase a monitoring capability off the shelf. This is a powerful tool for the state against forms of dissent. The ability of the internet to support dissent may increasingly be matched or exceeded by its ability to spy on dissenters. The issue of state surveillance of dissidents raised complicated questions for governments in the US and UK and made them frequently look schizophrenic. The crypto wars tensions had gone global. On the one hand, they wanted to support the use of the internet by activists abroad to challenge authoritarian regimes. To do this, those people needed the anonymity that the web provided with programs like Tor, originally developed with US government funding, and forms of encryption. But other parts of those same Western governments disliked the anonymity the internet offered and the power of encryption when it was used by criminals, enemy spies, and terrorists who challenged them. One part of the US government, the State Department, might back such tools, while another, the NSA, would at the same time be trying to find ways to hack into Tor and deprive people of their anonymity. Different countries want to talk about different things when it comes to cyberspace. Some focus on intellectual property theft, others crime, others militarization, others threats to social stability. Even within Western governments, different parts of the bureaucracy want to talk about different things: defense, democracy, security, or exports, to pick just a few. The issue cuts across too many departments and is often too complex for any single person to get a handle on. That has meant the dominant voices have been those who know the most and wield the most power: spies and the military.